Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Hal Brooks, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our third of four cases for oral argument this morning. Cases A21-0199, Lance Arnold Kingberg petitioner, appellant versus State of Minnesota respondent. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use that. And at the start of each of your principal arguments, if you could state your name and a party you represent for the record, we'd appreciate it. Counsel for appellant, we are ready for you if you're ready to go.
Thank you. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Lance Kingberg. In order to be timely, a petition for post-conviction relief must be filed within 2 years of when the defendant's conviction becomes final. Minnesota Statute 590.01 Subdivision 4 states that that time starts to run at the appellate court's disposition of the petitioner's direct appeal. The Minnesota Supreme Court has stated that cases remain pending until direct appeals are exhausted or the time for filing a direct appeal has elapsed. In the Loesch case, citing to the O'Meara case, the Minnesota Supreme Court has also stated that this time includes the time within which a defendant has to file a petition for cert with the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court will accept a petition for cert that's filed within 90 days of the entry of a judgment on a direct appeal, and that court actually won't docket a petition that's not timely filed. So since finality is measured from when the timing to file the petition for cert runs out, and the U.S. Supreme Court will accept a petition based on the date of the entry of judgment, Mr. Kingberg's petition would be timely if it was filed within 2 years of when the U.S. Supreme Court would have accepted his petition for cert. Mr. Kingberg did pursue a direct appeal here. His conviction was upheld by the Court of Appeals on April 30th of 2018. He petitioned the Supreme Court for further review. That was denied July 17th of 2018. And then the clerk of court entered judgment on July 25th of 2018. If we add the 90 days within which Mr. Kingberg had to file a petition for cert with the United States Supreme Court, his conviction became final on October 23, 2018. Therefore, to be timely, he had to file his petition on or before October 23rd of 2020, which he did. And I think a good indication that Mr. Kingberg was correct on that point is he also has pursued habeas relief in this case. He filed a petition on October 23rd of 2019. And in the federal court, the habeas timing is based on 1 year from when a defendant's conviction becomes final. And it's also measured by the same way, which is when the petition for cert is either denied or the timing to do that is run out. And because that habeas petition was viewed as timely by the federal district court, I think that's a good indication this is as well. And further, we think the cases cited by the prosecution in support of its position don't address the distinction between the opinion date and the entry of judgment date that's at issue here. And the cases were Hannon, Berkowitz, and O'Dell from the respondent's brief, and they were all pro se defendants. And it seems like there was no discussion whatsoever of whether or not this would be from the judgment date or from the entry of the order date. And I think, for one, the O'Dell case is really easily distinguishable here because that was a conviction that was from prior to August 1st of 2005. And the post-conviction statute explicitly stated that defendants with convictions from prior to August 1 of 2005 had 2 years within which to file a petition. Now, O'Dell's petition was filed in September of 2018, which was a solid 11 years past any chance that that petition was going to be timely. In Hannon,
I was going to ask you that, counselor. Is there any case where actually this will go to opposing counsel here, but I assume the record is, there seems to be agreement that on October 23rd, or there's no dispute that on October 23rd, your client could still have petitioned for review by the United States Supreme Court, right? That's not at issue. what's at issue is whether one measures our limitations period from that date or from the opinion date. And you're saying it's from the date that from October 23rd is when it started running, because that was the last day by which he could petition for Supreme Court review, right?
That is, yes.
Okay. And in the other cases, as reading them that talk about this and what the Supreme Court rule means, et cetera, and what is there any case in which there's a time difference such that we can tell whether it makes a difference, the opinion date and the time for Supreme Court review?
I am not aware of one, Your Honor. And I think at least the cases that were cited in the respondent's brief, I think the reason that it doesn't even come up is because they're so far out of time that it doesn't matter how finality is going to be measured. I think Hannon was over a year, and the Berkowitz case was over 4 years after that timing had run. And I'm not aware of a Minnesota Supreme Court case that addresses this distinction, but I think that it would be, if we kind of work backwards from the other cases that we cited in Mr. Kingbird's brief, which were cases like Loesch and O'Meara, which discuss how finality is calculated, I think it would be reasonable to conclude that the proper way to do this is to figure out when a defendant's petition for cert would last be accepted, and then work backwards from that in order to understand when the 2 years would run out.
So in speaking for myself, and I'm sure it's true, I think we understand the issues from the brief on this. If the district court were correct, just clarify for me that this was untimely. I know you're arguing that it's timely, and I understand your argument. Does it apply to all of the issues raised, or are there some? Does it dispose of the entire case if it was untimely? Are there still some arguments that you claim were timely? Is that the newly discovered evidence?
I do not think it would dispose of the entire case. I think the distinction would probably be anything that's raised as sort of that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for either not raising something correctly or for not raising it at all would be time barred, because then it would have been known at the time of the direct appeal and there wouldn't be anything there. There are some claims, and I think that Mr. Kingbird raised quite a few of them in his own pro se brief, that were based on some evidence that he discovered after the fact and based on things that he didn't have access to, in part because he wasn't able to get his file from counsel in a timely manner. And I think he probably put quite a bit of detail of that into his pro se brief. So I guess if the district court was correct that this was untimely, and we don't believe that it was, that it would dispose of sort of any of those underlying claims. And the district court also concluded that Mr. Kingbird's claims were largely procedurally barred as well. And we believe that that's inappropriate because Mr. Kingbird's raised them sort of under an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to properly raise the claims. And claims that are related to the effective assistance of appellate counsel are properly raised in post-conviction.
Mr. Longsdorf?
Yes?
I'm very unclear. It seems to me that the claim about ineffective assistance of appellate counsel is completely derived from the claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Is it not?
I think that's probably an accurate statement, that these are all issues that have to do with Mr. Kingbird's defense and things that he believes weren't properly raised by trial counsel, and then that his appellate counsel raised in such a way as that they essentially had no chance of succeeding, thereby depriving him of the opportunity to have warrant, you know, that relief would be granted on those.
Well, in the first post-conviction petition, I mean, the ineffective assistance of trial counsel was the issue. And that was what was looked at squarely by the district court there. And, of course, determination made that there was no merit to it. So it seems to me that that is gone. I don't understand then the basis for the appellate counsel claim.
I think where this stems back from is that Mr. Kingbird did raise these specific issues as part of that petition for post-conviction relief.
As part of the first petition?
Yes, they were raised as part of that, and then he was granted an evidentiary hearing where he had an opportunity to present the evidence to support these claims. But what happens at that hearing, instead of actually presenting the evidence, say the Diane Kingbird evidence, or I think it was Whitebird at the time, or her name had changed, to deal with the trichomoniasis or with these recordings or anything that had to go toward proving that AL's credibility was suspect in this case, all counsel did was have Mr. Kingbird get on the stand and testify about that, what he thought these folks would say or what he thought the evidence was going to show. And then the district court denies the petition and essentially says, well, there's no real evidence to support any of these things. And then the Court of Appeals takes the case up and affirms it, essentially saying the same thing. Well, there isn't actually any evidence supported, you know, to support these claims. And that's why as part of this claim, Mr. Kingbird has actually presented the evidence, which is what he believes should have been done in the first place. And then from there, we believe that if that had been presented in such a way that the evidence was there, it does actually support Mr. Kingbird's claim. And that's part of the reason why we think that this would work as sort of an interest of justice exception that would allow review of these claims even as individual claims, because Mr. Kingbird wanted to have this done. He tried to have it done, but the claims were presented in such a way as that they just had no chance of succeeding. And that's why we think that review in the interest of justice would be appropriate at this time.
I continue to feel like this is a repackaging of the same issues. I don't see how it is not. And therefore, it does seem like it's Nafflebar.
Well, we believe that the Nafflebar isn't applicable under these circumstances in the interest of justice for the reasons that I was just talking about, which is that we have sort of an external impediment. He tried to raise them. They weren't raised in a way that was going to be effective or have any opportunity of relief. And now that Mr. Kingbird was able to get his file to present this, view this evidence and present it, he's put it in there. And I think that if we analyze the merits of some of these claims, that if in fact there's merit to them and that the record does not conclusively show that Mr. Kingbird couldn't have had relief if they had been presented properly, that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny those claims without having an evidentiary hearing where Mr. Kingbird could present proof in support of the claims.
So he's still trying to argue ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
Yes, that's one of the underlying claims to the appellate counsel claim, is that trial counsel was ineffective. And in particular, one of the ways that had to do with that was that Diane Kingbird evidence. And that was something that Mr. Kingbird's appellate counsel actually did raise and then had Mr. Kingbird take the stand to testify about it. But they actually had Ms. Kingbird there, or she was in the courthouse, I understand, and could have testified, but didn't. But I think what that testimony would have shown, and it would have been in front of the district court, and in this earlier Court of Appeals opinion for Mr. Kingbird, it was noted that the district court just said, well, you know, all we have here is Mr. Kingbird's testimony, not the actual witness, so there's nothing to support it, and I can't make any conclusions based on that. But so if they call Diane Kingbird, for example, then the evidence is essentially that AL is telling her, my mom's mad because she thinks my dad has a girlfriend. Some girl called for him today. He left work and my mom doesn't believe him. And also that Diane Kingbird overheard CL tell AL, grandma said, if I don't call the police, she won't come get us. AL responded, I don't want to do that to dad, mom. He'll be in trouble. And what that does is, this was a case that was entirely about AL's credibility. And trial counsel actually did argue that. They said in closing that AL is lying. The whole case boils down to the credibility of AL. And if in a scenario where there's no physical evidence, there isn't any definitive biological evidence, there aren't any independent witnesses, anything that has to do with showing why the complaining witness might fabricate the allegations or that somebody else was putting pressure on that witness to fabricate any kind of allegations had to be raised as part of that defense. And this just didn't happen here. I mean, there was someone who was known to Mr. Kingbird, someone who was available, and it was evidence that he believes would have been admissible and could have been determinative of the outcome, where this case really truly came down to essentially AL's testimony, although repeated sort of by several people in positions of authority, and Mr. Kingbird's contention that this hadn't happened. And he believes that the same thing happened with these recordings that he had of CL that he had made after there was an incident where he thought that CL's mother was pressuring CL to make allegations against him. And he had these recordings, he made them known, he made them available. It wasn't stuff that was presented either by trial or appellate counsel, but it's evidence that would go toward suggesting a motivation to fabricate, or even the possibility that someone was having AL make these allegations, you know, sort of for someone else's agenda. And that's why it would have been so important. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal to counsel for responding.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dave Frank, and I'll be representing the respondent for today's hearing with the Beltrami County Attorney's Office. In this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant's second post-conviction relief petition without a hearing. The record certainly makes clear that the appellant is both procedurally barred and time barred from obtaining the relief. This court, as to the procedural bar and to address some of the issues raised by Judge Holbrooks, this court is well-versed in the NAFLA rule, which precludes any post-conviction claim being raised in the first appeal, and all claims that were known or should have been known but were not raised in the direct appeal. When the court reviews both the record in the second petition as well as the previous record, court will find that all of appellant's claims in the second petition for post-conviction relief have been previously addressed in the first petition, as well as the original appellate review back in 2018.
As a general rule, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel isn't NAFLA barred unless you, in fact, actually raise an appellate counsel ineffectiveness claim before, because you haven't yet had the opportunity to raise it, right? But the trial ineffective, if the claim is founded on a question of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, does that become like sort of some transitive math thing or something, also NAFLA barred if the appellate counsel claim is not NAFLA barred, but it's founded on a NAFLA barred trial counsel ineffectiveness claim?
Judge Smith, my review of the case law certainly suggests that if the issue on appellate counsel is based on the fact that they didn't raise or argue sufficiently the ineffective assistance of trial counsel, it is still derivative and NAFLA barred. That is my reading of the balance of the case law. And Your Honor, when the court looks at his underlying ineffective assistance of counsel claims, they have all been presented and they're now being repackaged. This court originally dealt with the allegation that trial counsel failed to call certain witnesses that the appellant believed would have been helpful to him in presenting a defense. The court, including the calling of Diane Kingbird, who apparently was available for trial and now I hear available for the hearing on the first petition for post-conviction relief. This court also addressed the claim that the victim suffered from a sexually transmitted disease, which the court and trial counsel and the prosecutor agreed was rape shield barred. The court also addressed the claims that the victim fabricated these allegations. These were all issues addressed, both in the first petition for post-conviction relief and the appeal. This court affirmed the district court's denial of the first petition. Appellant's efforts to repackage these same arguments should receive the same fate. He shouldn't get a second bite at the apple. This is not newly discovered evidence. This is not a novel legal theory. And as a result, these claims are not barred. And the district court correctly denied the petition without a hearing based on State versus NAFLA. They are also time barred. I guess I would disagree with my colleague as it relates to when the 2 years actually expires. I'd ask this court to simply review the statute.
I have kind of a problem with this. When I look at the stat, we know what the statute says, and then the district court has added the language that it has to be final, right? And when I'm looking at Hannon v. State from 2021, I think probably the Supreme Court's most recent, I assume, look at this, says that a conviction is final under the statute when the time for filing a petition for a writ of certiorari with United States Supreme Court has expired, and then cites to the Supreme Court rule. I think at this point on October 23rd, that time had not yet expired, but you're arguing it should date from when from an earlier date, and that's confusing to me. I know that Hannon went on to say that we're dating it from the opinion release date, but it doesn't tell us whether the opinion release date is different or the same as the judgment in that case. I mean, the court doesn't tell us that. And so I just wonder why we would look at, in that case, it's an actual opinion, not a denial of a PFR, but I'm wondering why we wouldn't just follow what the Supreme Court said, which is final when the time to petition for cert has expired. And we know that that was on the 23rd.
I think for the very reason that it presupposes that an appellate or petitioner would be filing a certiorari before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was never done here by the appellant. So why should we give him that time when there was no intent to?
Was it done in Hannon?
Certificate. That is unclear based upon a reading of the opinion, Judge Smith. But when you look at Berkovitz, when you look at Hannon, when you look at Odell, they all refer to when the decision was actually rendered by.
Right. They don't tell us when they cite the rule that we should look at it's final when the time for filing a petition has expired. And then they don't really tell us whether the judgment date was the same as release date or not. I don't think we have exactly your case, I guess, is my point before us, where there's a difference between the two and the court goes with the earlier one rather than the later one.
I do not have a case on point on that specific point, Judge Smith. That is correct. But the court needs to look no further than the statutory language itself. There are two reasons. There are two bases that start the two-year process. One, the entry of conviction, which indicates that the legislature has contemplated this. When does the clerk certify the conviction in the first two-year period? In the alternative, an appellate court's disposition. Note what the legislature did, the language that the legislature did not use. It does not indicate when the entry of the Supreme Court's decision. It simply says the Supreme Court's decision.
Let me ask you, are we in, well, maybe I'm confused. Are we under subdivision 4A1, the entry of judgment, if no direct appeal is filed?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Okay. I'm simply trying to explain why we go from the date when the Supreme Court hands its decision down, not when the entry of judgment is satisfied. The legislature could have used the same language that it used in the first exception, which is the entry of conviction. That contemplates a deputy court clerk entering that conviction. That's when it starts in the first instance. The legislature could have used that same language on an appellate court's disposition, but it chose not to.
We need to deal with the Minnesota Supreme Court's description of what 4A2 means in Hannon, whether one could make a different argument. Our Supreme Court has told us what it means. It's when the disposition is final, and it's final when the time period for filing a petition for a writ of cert with the U.S. Supreme Court has expired.
Right. Okay. And my argument, Judge Smith, is that you would simply, that presupposes filing certiorari. You don't get the extra time if you have no intention. I understand that Your Honor is shaking her head because you're focusing on the language. I'm just saying that Hannon Odell suggests something different.
Okay. Well, it's just that it deals with when the time period has expired. So I presume then that it wasn't done. If the time period expires, I presume they didn't file it. Otherwise, we'd probably be in a different factual situation if they didn't petition for Supreme Court.
Agreed, Judge Smith. So, but from this, and again, on that point, we asked the court to follow the law in Odell, Berkovitz, Hannon. I would also ask the court to look, and this also goes to Judge Smith's question, look at Hoyt Investment Company versus Bloomington Commerce. I would argue that it lends some support, and I'm quoting from the Minnesota Supreme Court decision. It is our view that once the original Court of Appeals decision, referring to a Court of Appeals decision, became final by virtue of the denial of the petition for further review, I would ask the court to consider that language when deciding this issue. I have cited to that case in my brief. Finally, Your Honor, I do wish to address one of the points that Mr. Longsdorf had in his petition and his brief. The state submits that there is no a Brady or Giglio issue whatsoever. We would ask the court to review the record very carefully. There was never an order from the district court. There was never a written order. And the record from the February 9th hearing establishes that the court never contemplated that the state would somehow provide further information on the issue of the New Mexico conviction. We would ask the courts to look at the February 9th hearing transcript, the March 20th and the March 23rd, as well as the pretrial hearing in June.
That sounds like it goes to the merits of a claim, whether there's evidence that would support the merits of such a claim. Is that why the district court or the post-conviction court here rejected it? Can you put that in context for me? How did those claims what was the district court's approach to them, the way you're describing?
I don't think the district court even addressed the issue. The district court simply said that the petition fails both procedurally and because it is time barred.
Okay, so if we were to disagree with the district court on both of those questions, would it then go back for a post-conviction court to actually consider it, or should we be considering that merits? It sounds more like the merits of such an argument, what you're describing.
Yes, Your Honor, it would. And if I think the court, first of all, has to determine whether or not the district court abused its discretion when it denied the second post-conviction petition. If the court agrees with that, I think appellant is done. The court needs not even look at that other issue. And unless there are any other questions, I would then yield the balance of my time.
It appears not. Thank you very much, Mr. Frank. Mr. Longsdorf, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I apologize, I was muted. Thank you. I want to address, I guess, part of what opposing counsel argued was, why do you get the time for cert if you don't file a petition for cert? But I think if we look at sort of Loesch, O'Meara, and the cases that determine finality and deal with sort of the when is a case final, when a new rule looks, you know, takes effect, which is a little different from this. But the way the Minnesota Supreme Court, I think, views it and look at it would be to essentially say that cert is part of your direct appeal. So you get the timing just like you would get the timing for a direct appeal. You know, your timing is determined by when your time to file a direct appeal would expire, even if you didn't file it. So I think that the Supreme Court looks at it that way. So I do think that Mr. Kingberg gets that 90 days, regardless of whether or not he files a petition for cert. Otherwise, I don't think the Supreme Court would say it the way they do, which is either you get when the time to file cert expires or you file it. They would just say, well, when you file it or you don't get it. And then the other thing I wanted to address was going back to sort of the STD argument and the rape shield determination, if you just look at the Court of Appeals opinion from Mr. Kingbird's direct appeal, I don't think that there's an absolute conclusion that this evidence was inadmissible. I think what the Court of Appeals actually said was that appellate counsel raised this claim, but they never even explained that the evidence was admissible or argued that it was admissible or tried to show how it could be used. And so I don't think we've had a determination here that says that this is inadmissible. And that's part of what Mr. Kingbird is trying to get raised at this point, is to show, look, this could be admissible. It could be a 412 issue because there is this clause in there about disease, and there is a procedure for a defendant to make an offer of proof to try to get this evidence in. And like the cases that were cited in his brief, the one out in North Carolina, that you can make a due process-based argument. And so really, what Mr. Kingbird's claim comes down to with this ineffective assistance appellate counsel is that if the underlying claim has merit, and we believe they do for the reasons that were cited in the brief, then it would be appropriate at least to have a hearing on it, because I don't think it should be too controversial that if he can show that the underlying claim has relief, that it should have been raised. And absent any further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. And your briefing, the case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.